Living quietly in New York, completely forgotten, was an Irish woman called Ethel Boole, who personified the very opposite of what Jiang Qing believed. Because Boole thought that the way to change the world was to give yourself up to the force of revolution, to surrender your individual self and your identity to the dream of a better future for others. At the end of the 19th century, Ethel Boole had gone to Russia as a young girl and become involved with the revolutionaries in St. Petersburg. And she wrote a novel called The Gadfly. It told a powerful romantic story of a young girl who sacrificed everything for revolution.
Psst. Which side are you on? Side two. You're with us. Come with me. Where are you taking me?
We don't have much time, and there's a lot you have to know.
Now, listen carefully. If the revolution is to be successful...
Excuse me. Wait, first
but there's the revolutionary leadership...
No, I was talking about the codification.
The codification is the central control.
Mm-hmm. Wait, what?
Well, do you want to talk about operation?
Yeah, I was... No, the protocol situation...
Let me, all right?
I just want to tell you about the expediency...
According to the regulation...
Check! Right, everything has got to be done in this time.
You have to have the priority of rank.
Right.
Do you mind if I...
Of course.
There is absolute security necessity.
Got it.
All of these operations.
I'll take it from here. Follow me. Right, Chief.
65.
Gentlemen. Gentlemen. I won't take any more credit for this victory than necessary. Lord Kitchener did not, nay, will not die in vain. Grid willing. Gentlemen, I, as leader, will use power like a drum and leadership like a violin. Pick out any idea, compare ideas with the one idea left, you have no doubt, and without a doubt, we have enthusiasm. Gentlemen, to make life whole. It's as easy as a bridge. Now, gentlemen, now that we have attained control, we must pull together as one, like a twin, keeping the prophecy of power as enthusiasm. All for one!
All for one!
And all for one!
And all for one!
Let me hear it for me!
You're under arrest!
She then married a Polish revolutionary called Wilfried Voynich. And in the 1920s, they went to live in New York, where he worked as an antiquarian bookseller. And Ethel Boole forgot about revolution. But in 1959, when the Bolshoi Ballet came to New York, the dancers were astonished to find that she was alive, and they rushed to visit her. Because Ethel Boole, without her realizing it, had become a hero of the Russian Revolution. She discovered that her novel had inspired millions of young revolutionaries in the 1920s to rise up and fight for the revolution, inspired by the idea of surrendering themselves to a grand historic cause. Then the same had happened in China. Again, millions of young revolutionaries had carried the gadfly in their backpacks, as they fought to create a new kind of future. Now, Boole was living alone, and she had inherited a mysterious book from her husband. It was called the Voynich Manuscript, and it was written in a language no one has been able to decipher. But one ballerina in the Bolshoi group didn't go to visit Ethel Boole. She was called Maya Plisetskaya. She was the most famous ballerina in the world, and she hated the communist system. Plisetskaya's father had been executed by firing squad during the purges of the 1930s. Her mother had been sent to a prison in the wastes of Siberia. As she became famous, she was watched all the time by agents from the KGB. She couldn't trust anyone. Everyone around her had been told to inform on her. And she hated what she called the men with sweaty faces, the party bosses who leered at her as she danced. In private, Maya Plisetskaya wrote out her own manifesto. I don't know about other people, she wrote. I'll say it for myself. I don't want to be a slave. I don't want people whom I don't know to decide my fate. I don't want a leash on my neck. I don't want a cage, even if it is a platinum one. I don't want to be rejected or branded. I don't want to hide what I am thinking. I don't want to bow my head, and I won't do it. That's not what I was born for. Both Plisetskaya and Zhang Qing were part of the new individualism that was rising up everywhere, while Ethel Boole's collective vision was dying. But at the same time, a new revolution was about to begin. It would offer a dream of liberation and freedom for the new individuals. But it would end by controlling them. And in a strange twist, the person whose ideas would guide that revolution was Ethel Boole's father. He was a mathematician from the 19th century called George Boole. Boole had been a deeply religious man, and one afternoon in the 1840s, as he walked across a field near Doncaster, a thought had flashed into his head that he believed was a religious vision. Boole suddenly saw how you could use mathematics to unlock the mysterious processes of human thought. The same symbols that were used in algebra could be used to describe what went on inside people's heads as they followed a train of thought, expressing all the twists and turns in simple binary form. If this, then that. If that, then not this. And in 1854, Boole wrote a book that caused a sensation. It was called An Investigation of the Laws of Thought. Its aim, to investigate the fundamental laws of those operations of the mind by which reasoning is performed. Boole showed how even abstract concepts like virtue and passion could be put into equations, and then the symbols used to follow a pattern of thought to its conclusion.
It's two postmen times three animal control officers divided by two gas meter readers makes how many bendable integrated community workers? Decode your answer now. Did you remember to carry the bum? Good. The answer...
Boole was driven by an almost messianic belief that he had been allowed a glimpse by God into the truth of the human mind. But there were those who doubted this. The philosopher, Bertrand Russell, was astonished by the brilliance of Boole's mathematics. But he didn't believe that what Boole had discovered was anything to do with human thought. Human beings, Russell said, do not think like that. What Boole was really doing was something else. Throughout the British Empire, science had played a powerful role which has been wiped and forgotten today. Its job had been to create abstract systems, to catalogue and order the chaotic reality that the British ruled over, to turn it into something that could be managed and controlled. It ranged from making maps of what was called the dark interior to cataloguing millions of species of animals and insects, and studying and categorizing different human types. And what Boole was doing was the next step in that process. He was taking the chaotic reality of human thought and making a simplified, rational map of that other dark interior, the human mind, so it could be managed and controlled. But in the 19th century, no one could see any way of using the system that Boole had created, and it languished and was quietly forgotten, and the British Empire began to collapse. Kerry Thornley had left California and gone to live in New Orleans, where he worked in a bar. The movement that he and his friend Greg Hill had started, Discordianism, was beginning to grow, spreading by word of mouth. Like much of the new counterculture, it was against all politics. It distrusted all the old systems of power, left and right, because they were just trying to force you into their version of reality. Thornley also published his novel, with Lee Harvey Oswald as the central figure. It was called The Idle Warriors. But New Orleans was also the city where Lee Harvey Oswald had lived before the Kennedy assassination. And as a result, Thornley came to the notice of the man who was going to be the main creator of the JFK conspiracy theory. He was the district attorney of New Orleans, called Jim Garrison. Garrison said that Oswald had just been part of a giant conspiracy that included the CIA, big business, the news media, and anti-Castro Cubans, who together had killed the president.
There's no question about that. There was a conspiracy. A number of men were involved. An apparatus which was lethal in nature, of which Harvey Oswald was a part, assigned a role essentially as decoy. Now, don't ask me what the organization is, because I can't say.
But the implication clearly is the Central Intelligence Agency, your own security organization in the United States.
It almost sounds like that, doesn't it? I have no comment about that.
Jim Garrison believed that the modern democratic system in America was just a facade, that behind it was another secret system of power that really controlled the country. But you could never discover it through normal means, because it was so deeply hidden. Garrison wrote a memo to his staff explaining how you could uncover this secret world. He called it time and propinquity. You didn't bother with meaning or with logic, he said, because that will always be hidden. Instead, you look for patterns, strange coincidences and links that may seem to have no meaning, but are actually telltale signs on the surface of the hidden system of power underneath. This theory was going to have a very powerful effect in the future, because it would lead to a profound shift in how many people understood the world. Because what it said was that in a dark world of hidden power, you couldn't expect everything to make sense. That it was pointless to try and understand the meaning of why something happened, because that would always be hidden from you. What you looked for were the patterns. And when Garrison read Kerry Thornley's novel, he saw a pattern. Not only had Thornley been in the Marines with Oswald and written a novel about him, but he had come to live in the same city that Oswald had lived in before the assassination. And in 1967, Garrison accused Thornley of being part of the conspiracy. Thornley was furious. He knew that Garrison was wrong. But he also hated the very idea of conspiracy theories. He believed that they were one of the ways those in power controlled you. Conspiracy theories made you believe that there were hidden forces that really controlled the world. And that made you as an individual feel weak and powerless. Suspicion, he believed, was just another form of control. Thornley wanted to find ways to free people from that kind of conditioning that held them back as individuals.
There are ways of deconditioning people. This is what I'm interested in. I'm interested in finding some technique by which great masses of people can be broken out of their authoritarian conditioning all at once to figure out exactly what that type of enlightenment is, that type of liberation from authoritarian conditioning is, and how to achieve it on a wholesale basis.
Thornley was right that most of what Garrison alleged was complete fantasy. Despite all the patterns, he could produce no evidence of a hidden conspiracy.
We interrupt the Late Late Show to bring you this bulletin from the KWKWT TV newsroom. This late word from New Orleans. The jury has returned a verdict in the Kennedy assassination trial. Former Louisiana Governor James Garrison has been found guilty on all counts. His attorneys will appeal the decision directly to the war president's spiritual advisor.
But what Thornley didn't realize was that at the same time, there was another very real conspiracy being run by the American government. And its aim was to try and do the very same thing as he wanted to do. The Central Intelligence Agency was trying to find ways to wipe the past from people's minds, to see if they could free them from the conditioning that had been implanted there. Psychologists working for the CIA had come to believe that individuals were far weaker than they had believed. And they wanted to see if they could implant new patterns of thought in their minds.
The image of the human being that was being built up at that particular time was that there was a great deal of vulnerability in every human being, and that that vulnerability could be manipulated to program somebody to be something that I wanted them to be and they didn't want to be. That you could manipulate people in such a way that they could be automatons, if you will, for whatever your own purposes were. This was the image that people thought was possible.
The CIA set up a secret project called MKUltra. It was led by a psychiatrist called Ewan Cameron, who worked in a hospital in Montreal called the Allen Memorial. He took patients and, without telling them, experimented to see if he could wipe what he called the sick memories from their minds. To do this, he used repeated electroshocks and massive doses of LSD.
They shipped me up to what they called the sleep room, and they gave me all of these electroconvulsive shock treatments and mega doses of drugs and LSD and all of that, and I have no memory of any of that. Nothing of that time in the Allen Memorial or any of my life previous to that. All gone. Wiped.
Some members of Discordianism were working at Playboy magazine. And Thornley decided that he was going to use Playboy magazine to start an experiment that would make people see how absurd all conspiracy theories really were. He called it Operation Mindfuck. In 1969, he and Greg Hill began Operation Mindfuck by placing a false letter in the Playboy letters page. They put it between another letter asking if gun fanatics had small penises, and one from a man asking about the physical danger to his testicles from heavy petting. Thornley's fake letter asked whether all the political assassinations in America were really being masterminded by a single secret society, and the society it named was the Illuminati. It said that the Illuminati were behind all the chaos and the fear that was now gripping America. He and the other Discordians then proceeded to spread this idea all across America through the counterculture, in magazines and books, and even in plays. Thornley's aim was to try and break the spell of conspiracy theories by making people see the absurdity of believing them. And he had chosen the Illuminati for the experiment because no one could possibly believe that an 18th century organization from Bavaria was really, in the second half of the 20th century, the secret rulers of the modern world. It was clearly ridiculous. Dr. Cameron's experiments were a disaster. His brutal technique succeeded only in wiping the minds of those he experimented on. He then found he could put nothing back. He totally failed to implant any new memories or any new ways of seeing the world. His patients found themselves in a world that had no meaning any longer.
When I was discharged from the Allen Memorial, I felt like an alien from another world visiting this world. I knew I was different, and I didn't know how to become like everybody else. And it was a very lonely, scary place to be. This is your husband. What's husband? What's making love?
In the world of individualism that was about to come, psychology was going to play a powerful role because it said it could help to change what was inside people's minds. But what Cameron and the CIA had done showed in a dramatic and extreme way the weakness of this. They had assumed that most of what people felt came from within them. And to make them happier, you just had to alter what was inside their brains. What was forgotten was the other view, that what shapes how people feel is the society around them. Above all, the structure of power that not only controls their lives, but also how they feel. And if you want to change the way people feel, you have to find a way to change that too.
Memory is wrapped in what society has decided we should feel like. You should cry at funerals. I found myself not crying at a funeral, and I felt just fine. And I thought, gee, there's something the matter with me. I'm not crying. I should cry. Everybody else is crying.
Michael de Freitas decided that he was going to become a revolutionary. He was going to challenge and expose the corrupt old structures of power that he believed still haunted and controlled the minds of the English people, even though their empire was gone.
I can't live in this system. I don't like it. I don't want it. I want it destroyed. Everything, down to the ground, the lot, ashes. That's what I want.
All three, Jiang Qing, Michael de Freitas, and Kerry Thornley, knew that their struggle was with the forces from the old power of the past that they believed were still lodged in people's minds. But at the same time, quietly rising up was a new system that seemed as if it would never have to face that struggle, because it would be completely free of the past. The laws of human thought that George Boole had created had become the central structure of all thinking machines, computers, because it fitted perfectly with the binary switching system inside them, either zero or one. and it was used by the machines to create endless branching pathways of binary logic, called algorithms.
I am going to perform for you my favorite digital story. 0011110001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 0011100001 Digital. How many times have I looked in the mirror and said, how can this man, a man born, the last baby born before the boom, born the day that Russia invaded Finland, born the day before Winston Churchill was 65 and would have, under normal conditions, retired. How could I, the youngest member of the generation whose oldest member is Bob Dole, have become digital? Well, I think I owe some of it to my remarkable mother. Back in Shaker Heights many years ago, she would from time to time spontaneously bemuse herself with the fact that Norbert Wiener, the inventor of cybernetics, had coined that word from the Greek root to herd sheep. Bah! The only computer I ever saw in school was a picture of the UNIVAC on the front page of the Weekly Reader. It looked like a huge gray toaster that took up three rooms. In college, I was never even in the same room with a computer, which is probably why in English 1, I missed the deep interactive significance of the Bard's soliloquy, to be or not to be. The first great branching thought in literary science.
Out of that was going to come the dream of artificial intelligence, machines that could think independently, that could then order and manage the world as a rational system, not driven by the dangerous ideologies of the past. But back in the 1960s, as the engineers began to build the first neural networks, what they had forgotten was that the system of thought they were creating inside the machines did have its own history. That it had been born out of a time when science had become deeply involved in questions of power and control in the British Empire. And that what lay behind the computer logic was the aim of simplifying human thought, which would finally allow you to colonize the last free outpost, the human mind. But unlike the old empires, where power was visible, this power would be hidden in remote places, in the servers. But something else from the past would also find its way into those servers. In the political and economic chaos of the early 1970s, conspiracy theories were going to spread like wildfire through the counterculture. As they did, the fake conspiracies about the Illuminati and the secret rulers of the world that Kerry Thornley thought that no one could ever believe began to get mixed up with the true conspiracies, like MKUltra. And more people began to follow Jim Garrison's theory of time and propinquity, looking for patterns of a hidden power in America, not for logic or meaning any longer. And when the internet was created, almost immediately, those patterns of suspicion would move into the data and multiply endlessly across the system. And that dark paranoia that 200 years before had spread across the prairies and the mountains among isolated settlers, now spread across the virtual world, among isolated individuals sitting alone in front of their screens. And suspicion and distrust crept back into what was going to be the new system of power.